Good morning and welcome to Politics Up Close on KCBW. I'm Jeff Robinson. Congress is on vacation until after the election, and that leaves local leaders like Salt Lake City Mayor Ralph Becker with an uneasy feeling with important decisions on spending and cutting left until after November 6th. So what implications could Election 2012 hold for Utah's capital city? Mayor Becker joins me now in the studio to discuss that, along with big potential changes in the city for how historic preservation works and other issues. Mayor, it's good to see you.
Jeff, always good to be with you.
Listeners, join us on the air with your questions and comments for Salt Lake City Mayor Ralph Becker. Our number is 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. Mayor, you were recently in Washington with other mayors from across the country. What was your message there, and how does the lack of action on the budget in Washington make you feel right now?
Well, I can tell you, as mayors, and this is not a partisan issue, it is across the board, are just astounded at the inability of Washington to deal with very basic issues we deal with every single day in our budgets, whether it's in our homes, in our businesses, certainly in our cities and in our states, to address the fiscal situation in our country. And it has enormous implications for us as a city, and really for all of us as a nation. When Congress simply will not sit down and work together to come up with an approach to address what is being called the fiscal cliff, which is at the end of this year, we'll see two major things happen that affects the federal government's budget. One is that sequestration occurs, and under the terms of congressional action that was taken now a year and a half ago, federal budgets will be cut enormously. Defense budgets and budgets involving our non-defense items in the federal budget, and it will just be a slash and burn policy. We will see it affected everything from funding for teachers to funding for cops to funding for highways to funding for transit in a way that will drastically affect our ability to complete these projects and to meet the commitments that we and the federal government has made. On top of that, there will be some Bush cuts, Bush-era tax cuts that would come to an end. That means everybody's taxes will go up. At this time when we're slowly emerging from this economic condition and that when Congress has a responsibility to address these issues, for them to fail to take them on and to just try to spin the issues as a political and public relations matter, to us as mayors, is inexcusable.
Do you think it's any worse right now than it's been in the past, the lack of action in Washington, or is it pretty much the same thing you saw throughout your first term as mayor as well?
Well, it seems to me a continuation of what I think we've been seeing. But as Congress fails to act, as the paralysis continues, the effects become more and more severe on all of us as a community. And it's easy to say, oh, we're just going to cut $1 trillion here, $1 trillion there out of the budget. The budget is fat. But it's not that simple. And all of us who have been involved in budgeting, as I said, whether it's in our households or in our businesses or in our communities at the city level, know that is a completely irresponsible way to address dealing with budgets. And we've had at the federal level the Simpson-Bowles Commission come forward with a balanced approach to how to fix our fiscal problems in the federal government. President Obama came forward and with a variation on that. Congress needs to sit down and get to work and look at, okay, where do we make efficiencies and cuts in government? Those have been happening, but they obviously need to continue. Where can we reasonably raise revenues and not adversely affect the economy? And for people to say, oh, we don't need to do those, the Simpson-Bowles Commission consisted of the most conservative and the most liberal members of Congress as well as others from outside of the Congress. And they passed by a majority that included the most conservative and liberal members of that commission a proposal. And why Congress won't take it up, make whatever modifications they feel and refinements they feel are appropriate and address it, to me is just doesn't make any sense and really has potentially horrific effects for an economy that's struggling.
This is Politics Up Close. My guest is Salt Lake City Mayor Ralph Becker this morning. Join us on the air, 801-355-TALK. 801-355-8255 is a number to call. You can also reach out to us on Twitter at KCPW. Now, here's a big question, Mayor. How do you think Salt Lake City will be affected, depending on whether Mitt Romney or Barack Obama is in the White House for the next 4 years?
Well, I think that's very difficult to say in the case of Governor Romney. With President Obama, I think we know. We've been working with him for 4 years. Again, across the board and regardless of party, President Obama is considered to be the most sensitive, knowledgeable, and practical in how he addresses urban issues in our country. And almost 90% of our population lives in urban areas. So it's really all of us when we look at our communities and the people we serve. Under President Obama's administration, we have seen some pretty dramatic changes that don't get a lot of attention. For example, he has told his department heads, and they have now worked through this in large part, in transportation, environmental protection, in the environment and housing and urban development. So really all of those areas that affect us in the communities as a whole, to work together, to have their programs meshed together, and to figure out how to do things that we're accomplishing from a community's perspective, like Salt Lake City's, what we want to and need to accomplish so that their programs and their funding are integrated. It is the reason that Salt Lake City, for example, was able to get a substantial amount of federal funding for our Sugar House streetcar line, was because those agencies were looking at how do we best use the federal resources we have, and we as taxpayers pay into the federal government, mm-hmm. To play their role as partners in community development. Now, some people would say, oh, that shouldn't be the federal government's role. We would not have an interstate highway system today. We wouldn't have a transcontinental railroad today if the federal government didn't play a role in national level issues. And I'm one of those who believes, well, we need to have a very efficient and limited government. But we also need to have a government that's responsive to the needs of folks. And I think in this administration, I have seen, and mayors across the country and cities across the country have seen, a government that looks to support local government in a way that's responsive to the needs of local government. With a President Romney, certainly he's someone who has been a friend to Utah, knows Utah. He had a home here for quite some time over in Deer Valley area, and he was here for the Olympics. So he's someone that we would hope would be friendly towards the state. But I've got to tell you, having watched his campaign unfold and followed his work when he was governor of Massachusetts, that I have no idea what Governor Romney will do as president. As much as I would like to say, I think he'll be friendly to Utah, I do not know what that means in terms of what that means in his administration of the federal government. I would hope he would apply the kind of competency and practical sense that obviously he learned and has learned being a very successful business person. But his policies have literally gone around the circle two or three times in terms of what his positions have been so much since he's been governor of Massachusetts and as presidential candidate that I have no idea what he would do as president.
We were talking about the impact of cuts, Mayor. Let me ask you, are you as concerned as those on the right perhaps about the size of the national debt, and does that have an effect that could impact Salt Lake City as well?
Certainly. I mean, we have got to deal with this fiscal condition in the federal government. I think it was a situation that was made worse when George Bush was president in the early 2000s. In fact, he came in with a budget surplus and went out with a very serious budget condition. And then when President Obama came into office, which was a year after I did, and so I know what it feels like, he faced a situation where the economy was in a free fall, and he took an approach that at the time was very well agreed upon by, I think, virtually all economists and folks who look at how we can give a good jolt to the economy, which was to reinvest in a very targeted way in things that we need in our community with federal resources. That has created, between the Bush era dollars spent and between this administration, the Obama administration's dollars spent, a fiscal problem that we have got to address, and it's going to take time for us to get out of. But all of us who deal with budgets of any significance, in the case of Salt Lake City, it's an $800 million budget, know that you do it by carefully looking at how do we preserve our core and basic services, mm-hmm. And facilities, how do we invest towards our future in a way that moves our community forward or our nation forward. And how do we look for where we can achieve efficiencies? We eliminated whole departments in the city in my first 3.5 years when we had to make significant cuts in our budget. And where can we reasonably raise some revenues in a way that does not hurt the overall economy and that really helps create more equity within our fees and taxes systems? I haven't raised taxes in my 5 years now in office and don't intend to if in any way it's possible. And we were able to do it by very carefully going through and developing a budget. And while the federal budget is enormous, we have a whole Congress and we have a whole administration to be able to look at how to do that. And it's not going to come just by cost cutting. I mean, it is obvious to every economist who looks at this picture that it is a fairy tale. If people think we're just going to cut budget by trillions of dollars to balance the budget in a little while and not dramatically affect our defense, which is our number one priority as a country at the federal level, and dramatically affect cops on the street, teachers in our schools, transportation systems. We can go across the board. It has to be done in a way that's balanced and look towards what our needs are and how we can do this in a way that sustains an economy for the future.
This is Politics Up Close here on KCPW. We're speaking this hour with Salt Lake City Mayor Ralph Becker. Join us on the air with the mayor, 801-355-TALK. 801-355-8255 is the number to call. And you can send us your questions and comments on Twitter at KCPW. I'm Jeff Robinson. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Politics Up Close here on NPR Utah, KCPW. I'm Jeff Robinson speaking today with Salt Lake City Mayor Ralph Becker. Join us on the air, 801-355-TALK is the number, 801-355-8255. Send us your questions and comments on Twitter at KCPW as well. And Miriam is on the line. Miriam, what's your question or comment for Mayor Ralph Becker?
Good morning, Jeff. Good morning, Mayor. Aside from what the federal government will be deciding for Utah, I'm actually much more concerned about what our own Utah government will be deciding for Salt Lake City. And I wonder what your opinions are as far as the positions of Governor Herbert and Peter Cook and our congressional candidates, how these different things will affect what Salt Lake City needs, like transportation. I sit on your 8AA board, and so some of these issues are very important to me as well.
All right, Miriam, thanks for the question. We appreciate it. So impact of the state budget and what you're seeing from Governor Herbert or his challenger.
Well, as cities, we are what is referred to in the law as creatures of the state. So in the case of Utah particularly, if the state of Utah wants to tell Utah what to do or not to do, it can do that. It has that power under the law. It's not quite as general and broad as I've indicated, but as a matter, that's true. And so we are always concerned and feel very dependent on the decisions that are made at the state level when they affect Salt Lake City. And that's true whether it's something that is directly in our responsibility as city government, like our own streets and our own transportation systems and lighting or whatever else it may be, or whether it's something that is indirect, like our education system, where we want our kids to have a healthy opportunity for their future. And so when the state, which has its biggest part of its budget and thereby in a way its largest responsibility towards education, doesn't address those issues well, it affects very directly our city. I have, as I think you know, Miriam, and others may know, I was in the state legislature for 11 years. And so it both brought me a familiarity with the way state government works. I was previously worked for Governor Matheson in the 80s as well, but familiarity with how state government works and how the legislature and the governor makes decisions. And I've appreciated that I've had a very good relationship both with leadership and others in the legislature, as well as with Governor Herbert and his predecessors. And I think that's important for me to state from the beginning that I like Governor Herbert. And I enjoy many members of the legislature personally. We tend to have a little different view of the world in Salt Lake City than most of the state of Utah. I accept that. I recognize that. Mm-hmm. And I have consistently asked that the state respect that we are different and let us operate within our realm appropriately as local governments. I've got to say that the legislature and Governor – I'll distinguish the legislature from Governor Herbert. There are members of the legislature who seem to have a real disdain for Salt Lake City, and that's unfortunate. We are the capital city. We are the real generators of both the biggest revenues in the state per capita, but also the source of the greatest part of the economy. And being the home to places like the University of Utah and Westminster and the BYU campus and others, the source of really the economic future through innovation and entrepreneurship that's coming out of those institutions. So we have, I think, a particular role as it relates to state government that we respect. So when we see the state not acting, in my view, in a way that is both responsible and supportive of our city, which happens every year, or there are certainly proposals every year, that's damaging to our community and I think is damaging overall to the state. And to point to specifics there, when the state tells us that we cannot fund, for example, our light rail line to the airport, which they did, and money had been set aside at the airport, with revenues from the airport for the portion of the light rail line at the airport, it puts us and Utah Transit Authority and others in a very difficult position to try to figure out how to get projects done. And I could go on issues where the state has challenged us, but I will say that for the most part, we've had very good relations with both the legislature and Governor Herbert. Certainly, I believe that General Cook would be a terrific governor. There are few people in this state that have the breadth and the strength of background that he brings and would bring, I think, to the office, both because of his military background and knowing how to help with major issues in the state like Hill Air Force Base. But also I think his commitment to the people is unusual, and a sensitivity to people and to people who are a little more vulnerable in our state. I think he would be a terrific governor. I will say that Governor Herbert, and sometimes to my surprise, has been very responsive to us in the city. Last year when we had a challenge from some legislators to overturn our idling ordinance, our no idling ordinance, for example,
right,
Governor Herbert stepped forward and at least privately said, if that bill comes on my desk, I will veto it. And he stood up for us as a local government to make those decisions. He has also, I think, agreed to work with us on a whole variety of issues, respecting the fact that we as a city should be able to deal with our local issues. And there are always going to be people. You've got 104 people in the legislature. There are always going to be some members who I think are going to think they have all the answers for everybody else. And those who don't live in Salt Lake City think they should tell Salt Lake City what to do. And I intend and will forcefully resist when it's something I think that's important for our community, like our non-discrimination ordinance, for example, that we passed and was challenged in the legislature, to try to make sure that policies that are important for our city and that reflect our city remain on the books. But, you know, it's It's always a challenge. It seems like every year, I expect it every year, we're going to be challenged on things we do in the city because there's some in the legislature who thinks they know our city better than we do, and we can't responsibly address our city's needs.
Miriam, thanks for the call. Join us on the air with Mayor Ralph Becker, 801-355-TALK, 801-355-8255. And Mayor, getting to another specific issue where the legislature has been involved, let's talk about the changes the Salt Lake City Council considered this week to the way historic preservation is done in the capital city. Now, as I mentioned, this comes as the legislature has kind of intervened, has put another moratorium on new historic districts in the city. But this latest proposal considered by the council would change it to a system where these districts are designated via popular vote. You know, you go out, you get a petition, you get a certain number of signatures, and then everybody's mailed a ballot, and, you know, it's literally done via vote, just like a regular election. What do you think of this plan, and do you think it's right for the city?
Well, we are incredibly fortunate in Salt Lake City to have these historic neighbors proximate to our downtown. It makes for a wonderfully livable community. It gives our community character and depth that is unusual for any city anywhere in the country. And had it not been for the actions in the beginning, I think, in the late 70s and early 80s in places like the Avenues, when the Avenues were downtrodden and we were seeing homes getting bulldozed and apartment houses getting built, and losing a lot of the character of that area. Had it not been for both the downzoning of the neighborhoods at that time and the creation of an historic district, we probably would have lost that, really what we all kind of tend to view now as a real treasure of a neighborhood. And we saw it again in Capitol Hill, and we've seen it literally in about a dozen places around the city where historic districts have worked well. The Yale Crest historic district fight, I think, caught some of the residents there by surprise because Yale Crest is really one of our most beautiful historic neighborhoods. And it created a level of acrimony that some folks who've been in this arena now for many, many decades have never seen a neighborhood at war the way Yale Crest went to war within itself over creation of an historic district. And the concerns reflect probably changing times where historic districts maybe aren't always the best tool, but also maybe just this kind of acrimony we see throughout society today based on ideological views. In this case, someone should be able to do whatever they want with their property, property rights advocates versus those who think that the community should have a say and a strong say in a neighborhood and what happens in a neighborhood and protecting the other neighbors and how development occurs. And that's always the balancing act in planning. I come back to your question here. I'm sorry I wanted to give that sort of background, but I think we're seeing our city council, appropriately so, deliberate very thoroughly in the wake of the Yale Crest historic district fight. What are the tools we should have going forward for protecting our neighborhoods and still allowing people to modernize their homes and build new structures where appropriate in a way that doesn't destroy the fabric of that neighborhood? They came up, I think, with a tentative idea as it related to the future of historic districts, and maybe this would apply as well to a new category they'll have called conservation districts or compatible neighborhood districts. Where it would take a majority vote of people to institute an historic district. You know, I don't have a problem with that. When you look at Yale Crest, we saw that both sides claimed they had a majority. And if there was a way to ballot the residents in a way that was fair and easy so that we could do it in a way that we could try to make sure we had some decent representation or some good representation from the neighborhood, then it would settle the issue, and whatever the conclusion was, the neighborhood could go forward with an historic district or a conservation district or whatever tool, and there's a range of them that might be available for a neighborhood to try to make sure they protect their neighborhoods and still allow people to develop and redevelop their property. So I actually think it may be a suitable solution. Now, since the legislature has decided to step in and tell us as a city what we should do with historic districts, which I find both offensive and completely wrong and antithetical to this concept that those of us closer to home and in local areas should be able to make our best decisions. I don't know how the legislature will respond to that. They put a moratorium on further historic districts, and
right.
In my mind, it was kind of silly because the city council wasn't going to adopt an historic district anyway. But I would hope they would allow us to make decisions. And as we have done, and our city council, I think, has done well, deliberate carefully over what the options are and what's going to work, and let us evolve and adapt over time as we experience whatever standards we put in place for our community and our neighborhoods.
Do you think, though, that voting is the best choice here? I know I read a quote from Kirk Huffaker of the Utah Heritage Foundation in the Tribune saying this is not the kind of thing that should be left to a vote. And there are certain decisions in our society where the elected officials are the ones we entrust to make those decisions rather than leave it to a direct ballot. Does that process raise some concerns for you?
Yeah, it does in a way. I mean, one of the things we certainly saw in Yellcrest, and this was from both sides to a certain extent, was some pretty outrageous claims about what an historic district meant or didn't mean. And, you know, there's always that potential or likelihood certainly of claims in a debate. You know, but I have a lot of confidence in an electorate that they will become informed sufficiently. And we'll provide them plenty of information, and there'll be plenty of debate within the neighborhood, and people can make up their own minds about whether or not they want an historic district. So I appreciate those who say, you know, this is an elected official's responsibility, and I think that's true. And I think there's some matters that certainly are both sort of technical enough and don't get enough public interest that it just does not make sense for those to go to a decision of the public that isn't likely to get informed enough and expects us who are elected to make those decisions. Historic districts, at least today, are sufficiently controversial and get enough public attention that I think people will become adequately informed to make good decisions within their neighborhoods.
This is Politics Up Close. We're speaking with Salt Lake City Mayor Ralph Becker. Join us on the air at 801-355-TALK, 801-355-8255. Mayor, a couple weeks ago, my colleague here at KCPW, Jessica Gale, did a story on how the city's anti-idling ordinance is being enforced, and she was told that since it went into effect about 6 months ago, only 6 warnings have been given out to residents who were idling too much. Now, I know this was primarily an educational effort to get people to reduce their idling, not something aimed at making people pay big fines or anything along those lines. But isn't it a bit concerning to hear that only 6 warnings have been given out since this ordinance was passed?
So, Jeff, you don't think it's because people have stopped idling?
I was in the airport park and wait the cell phone lot, and there were probably 10 cars around me idling for more than 10 minutes.
And that is an area where we have plenty of signage, I know, having been out there a number of times. You know, I guess I don't have a really good sense about, you know, the strength. Really, the enforcement, I think, has only been in place a few months. And I think the desire is to really educate people and that having a standard in place gives us a good foundation to do that.
Mm-hmm.
I would hope, and it's really our parking enforcement officials that are really have the responsibility to look out for idling and to, you know, that you know, they might just come up and tap on someone's window and say, hey, do you know we have this this standard in place in the city? Would you please turn off your car without having to write a warning? And probably only if someone, you know, gets angry about it or says, well, I'm not going to do it, then it's probably time to probably let people know through a warning. And I think we have in place a 3 warning process before any tickets would be issued. So, you know, I'm not concerned about it. I think that the dialogue you and I are having today and we had for months, and then when the legislature decided they wanted to try to intervene, we had for more months, helps raise people awareness. And I think what I hear the most is that people who become aware and conscious of their idling, and they don't need to leave their cars on for minutes or longer at a time, and start to turn them off, it's like, well, when they don't need to be idling, go, well, this is such an easy thing to do. It helps our air quality and our health and our pocketbooks and our energy situation. And why isn't everybody else doing it once you sort of adopt it yourself? So I'm not particularly concerned about it. I hope our enforcement folks take it seriously, but I hope they also realize that our primary intention here is to raise people's awareness, and I think that in itself will ultimately address the issue.
Mark is calling with a question for you, Mayor Becker. Hi, Mark. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. So I want to move back to a zoning issue. I built a fence. I used a material that the city code says I can't, galvanized steel. And my problem with the zoning issue is that it's the greenest fence I could build. It's the highest quality fence within, in a couple mile radius of my house. And the city says I have to take it down, even though there's lots of fences made out of roofing materials on my side of town. And so I know that the mayor can't change the zoning ordinance, but it is his enforcement officials that are insisting that I remove it.
Interesting question, Mark.
So, Mark, let me ask you, and you don't need to get too specific on this. Are you in an historic district, or are you in a part of town?
I'm on the west side of Salt Lake City.
Okay.
I'm straight west, basically straight west of the city building.
Yeah.
So, at about 12th West.
Okay, great.
I built a very tasteful galvanized steel fence. Right. It's almost an art project.
Well, I don't know your specifics, and I don't want to sort of prejudge what our folks did or what you did, but let me just sort of give you a basic response, and I'll be happy to follow up. If you want to contact our office, I'll be happy to inquire and at least make sure that we were reasonable in enforcing the standards we have in place for fencing. We have fencing standards for a variety of reasons in a variety of different places. One of the things that we look at for fences is, do they so interfere with the transparency of properties that they really create a walled effect in a neighborhood? So we've had people, for example, and this is not you, Mark, I realize. We've had people, for example, build 12-foot high walls and call it a fence. And you get that along a street corridor, and pretty soon you think you're in a walled enclave in a neighborhood, and that's not something under our zoning that we permit. So we put height standards on fences, for example, and we put transparency standards on fences. In historic districts, we have for all of the exterior areas that are face a street particularly standards, so there's some compatibility of materials with the neighbors. So, for example, chain link fences aren't allowed in historic districts, as I recall, because that's not it's not consistent with the historic character of a neighborhood. And building a fence is, like so many other things, that requires a permit from the city. And I think if you had, and maybe you did, but if you had gone into the city and said, hey, I'm going to build a fence, they would have said, look, here are our standards. And they would have worked with you to make sure that as you built your fence, it met the standards. We really work hard, and I can tell you that the permitting operations I follow closely enough and have lived with both before, but obviously particularly since I've been mayor, we've really worked hard to work with our residents and our businesses on our standard, on our permitting process so that it is fast and efficient and practical and reasonable, but standards are in place usually for a good reason, for health and safety reasons and for good community reasons. So I don't know the specifics of your situation. I know that in your part of town, we certainly have a lot of chain link fences. So I don't know why that wouldn't be permitted. But I'd be happy to look into it. If you want to just contact our office, I'll follow up with you.
Mark, we appreciate the call. Mayor, we only have about 2 minutes left with you this morning, but let's get to the recent neighborhood pups ordinance passed by the Salt Lake City Council, something that certainly generated quite a bit of discussion in the city. What did you get out of this ordinance that you were looking for? What did you not get? I know there was a compromise in there. And what do you think this will mean in the next couple of years in the city?
Well, having the council finally take action, it's been before them for a couple of years now, on the last part of our liquor ordinance, liquor policy and law changes, I think was a good thing for the city as a whole and for the community. to have finally addressed. Just to back up for a second, I know we've only got a couple minutes here. 2 years ago, we really overhauled the structure of the ordinance, simplified it, did away with anachronistic kinds of standards, archaic standards like a limit in the downtown of 2 liquor serving establishments per block face and things that just didn't make sense. The neighborhood portion of this, where we now allow in certain neighborhoods under very restricted conditions, things that we would normally call bars or all kinds of designations under Utah law, I think will help contribute to our neighborhoods. It's important that we provide for people, so we want a walkable community, and in neighborhoods like 9th and 9th in these larger commercial areas, for people to be able to go and meet together and socialize and have a drink is something that many people expect and we want to provide for. So I think it's a very positive direction for our communities. It's very limited. People have to provide security plans. They're in that business. And they have to do a whole variety of things, limiting hours of operation, that sort of thing, we hope, with some help from legislative changes, by the way, that will accomplish dealing with impacts on a neighborhood. As this ordinance unfolds, I think you'll start to see some small neighborhood bars spring up in certain parts of our commercial areas in the city where they haven't been permitted before. It will, of course, depend on whether or not there are liquor licenses available for those kinds of establishments. But I think over time you'll see that happen, and I personally think it's something people aren't even going to notice or make a big deal about. But like everything, when we consider something, you get people coming out, they're concerned about things. Sometimes it's hard to believe, I know, but sometimes they'll say things that aren't accurate about what may happen based on what their concern and skepticism is. And I think we feel good that we've ended up in a place, and it's really largely where we started a few years ago now, we'll end up in a place that will serve the community well.
This is Politics Up Close. We've been speaking with Salt Lake City Mayor Ralph Becker. Mayor Becker, thanks for your time.
Always good to be with you, Jeff. Thank you.
I'm Jeff Robinson. We'll be right back.